The following is a special presentation of WCHL News. Now, a WCHL News special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. Chancellor Folt has officially been on the job for 4 months. And in a four-part series, you'll hear, in a wide range of topics, what the Chancellor has been doing in the early days as leader of North Carolina's flagship university. Here's Jim with Chancellor Folt.
Chancellor Folt, welcome to WCHL.
It's great to be here.
Do you still feel it's appropriate to say welcome to Chapel Hill, or do you feel already that you're part of the furniture here?
I don't think I'm part of the furniture yet. I'm starting to feel like I'm meeting people for the second, third time, which is wonderful, but still a lot of new people to meet and things to learn.
After you get past the typical sound bites, when we always ask the new chancellor, we have, so tell me what your impressions are. In the interest of time, I know that everybody's been wonderful to you. So we always talk about how wonderful everybody's been. When it comes to getting your hands around the job, what have been your first impressions of the scope of the job? And how much do you think so far, you're in your fifth month now, how much do you think you have your arms around it?
You know, I think the scope of the job is similar at all universities. So in a lot of ways, I came understanding what we do. But there are many more entities, so one of the things I've been trying to do with the new provost is to go around and visit all the schools. We've gone to 10 of them so far, giving us a much better
idea.
The schools on our
within
campus.
Within our university.
Public health, education, summer school, medical school, and so on. And we've spent 2 hours at each of those schools, so it's that opportunity to learn more than the superficial, to do that deep dive that has been extremely helpful.
When we sat here 5 years ago with Holden Thorpe, we said, okay, what's your job one? And he instantly said, campus security. He was just very clear. He had already thought about it. What's that? So if you've been here, he had had a little bit of a history because we had had some campus security issues, and you're arriving here new. What's your job one? What's the first thing that you want to get done here?
Well, I think that is true. It is campus security. This health and safety of the students and the people on campus is an aspect of the job that you think about every single day. When that is going well and you can feel confident, you, are, of course, are diving into everything else, the student experience, the research opportunities. I've been having a great time really learning about the town, getting to understand the local legislature, going around and starting to visit different campuses in different parts of the state, and then also getting to know the people that are in Washington. So it has quite a large scope, but that safety is right there at the top.
What's the most daunting part of your job?
I think it's daunting to embrace the fullness of an institution. There are so many parts of an institution. As chancellor, you really want to feel like you understand it. So in the beginning, it's getting that opportunity to really understand more than the superficial. I think the complex environment of higher education right now could be viewed by some people as daunting. We're trying to balance financial pressures and other. On the other hand, it's also the most exciting time possible in higher education with exploding knowledge and new opportunities. So I tend to see that on the balance as a positive.
Historically, Bill Friday once loved to say when the governors would be carrying on, he would say, Bill, the governors, they come and go, but the University of North Carolina just, it will be right here after this governor is gone. In that same sense, how important is the chancellor? You've got a huge bureaucracy, a big labyrinth, and certainly it was daunting for your predecessor. How important is the chancellor?
I think the chancellor has a very important role in the institution because they're given this incredible privilege of the platform, the opportunity to go to meetings, to represent the institution, to speak across constituencies, that opportunity to use the position to be a person that helps bring forward the aspirations and the goals is of great importance. The chancellor also has to build a team. Because, of course, an institution like this really isn't run by a single person. It really is run by a very large and important team. And that's been the focus of much of my early work, is bringing together the people that would be in those key roles. Then, as the chancellor, you help work with a team like any coach does. You're working together. You're trying to solve problems. Your energy comes towards that, those issues. And so I think in each of those ways, you have a major role. And you also have the opportunity to set a face. you know, bring forward a face for the institution. You speak on their behalf.
What sort of scorecard? What are the metrics, or what's the philosophy or the policy? How do you go about picking those people on that team? And you're very much in the stages. You've got a couple of the fairly important hires, but you still have some very important ones to go. So we'll talk about that. But where do you start up sort of at the 30,000-foot level? Do you have a philosophy about the kind of people you want to hire?
I do. I think quite a bit about that. For me, a really important aspect of that leadership role is that the person has the character and the leadership qualities that will make their own team very excited to work with them. Integrity, high levels of leadership and responsibility go with any of those leadership positions in the institution. They also need to be people who love the collaborative nature of the university. It's a chaotic place, but you need to be able to enjoy bringing people together.
How about the inside-outside component of it? You're certainly from the outside and with relatively little, well, with no institutional history here. Appointing Jim Dean as your provost, and now David Ruth as the director of development, were inside hires. You still have a vice president of communications to hire and a vice chancellor for business and finance. How important is local knowledge, institutional history in hiring them, or do you feel that you've got Jim and David over there to give you that, to give you the inside point of view?
With all those hires, we actually didn't, I wouldn't consider them inside hires. We actually had full searches, national searches, and interviewed people that were both inside and outside. The goal in all those cases was to get the most skilled, the best person.
So the fact that they had an institutional knowledge, the fact that Jim Dean was a provost, pretty important role over there. If you're an outsider, what I'm hearing you say is that if someone else had credentials equal to Jim Dean's, that the fact that he was of the institution was not a factor in his being hired?
Well, the fact that he's of the institution, of course, is who he is. He has an incredible knowledge and insight about the future of higher education that plays out in this place. But when we did the interview, and there was, of course, a wonderful search committee, they looked just as carefully as inside and outside candidates. I was so excited when I met Jim. He was just the right person for this job, and his inside understanding of the institution is wonderful. But really, quite honestly, we were looking for the best person. And I think for Jim, I think for David, we found those candidates. Maybe not surprising that they would be from Carolina. This is a fantastic place with a lot of talent. So it's been quite wonderful for me. But with each of these searches, we've really been saying, let's find the right talent that can help this institution move forward.
David Ruth is, in many respects, and those of us who've been here for a long time who've known Mr. Ruth and who knew Matt Kupek would say that David Ruth, in terms of his personality, is the anti of Matt Kupek. Matt was big, effusive, bold, former football player, big sort of inspirational, extroverted speaker. David Ruth operates on a quieter plane. Was that a factor in all of this, given some of the controversies that surrounded Matt when he left?
Honestly, I've never met Matt. Uh-huh. This my selection of David had really nothing to do with the prior holder of that position. I really was looking for the person that could really be right for this position right now and help take us forward. David brought such a depth of knowledge to this position. He knows how to work with people. He is a team builder of extraordinary capacity. So I think those were the issues that were top of mind for me and I think for the committee.
Now, when Matt Kupek was in South Building and had two jobs, he was both your communications director and he was your director of development. And there was a general sense that he was somewhat estranged from his staff that operated over on Franklin Street. Where are you going to put David Ruth?
Well, David has an office in South Building as well. He will also continue to have, you know, he'll share two offices. He'll be back and forth between where the rest of his development staff are and sitting in that main office very close by my office. I think it's really important that we have lots of interaction, but of course he's building a team, and that's important that he spend time there as well.
So you're going to have him, he'll be in both places.
That's right. We're splitting time back and forth.
So what are you looking for in a communications director.
Communications for universities has really changed so much just in the last 10 years. And it isn't just the birth of the whole digital world, but that's had a big influence on the way we communicate. But I believe to be really relevant in these times, we need to be exploiting our capacity to reach people through social media, through regular traditional media, through opportunities for opening forums. We have a wonderful journalism school that gives us lots of ideas. So this communication strategist needs to help us in many different realms.
Let's talk about practical matters. There is a widespread view among university watchers that the university has not managed its message very well. Are you aware of that?
I certainly heard that.
And so I'm not sure I heard much about getting the university's message right now.
Universities are large, complex organizations. We create and generate immense content. There are more discoveries and creative opportunities to talk about that's part of a main mission of communication. That needs to be important. We're out in the state doing things of immense good. We need to communicate about that. We're also welcoming the public into thousands of seminars. We need to communicate about that. We're trying to keep in contact with our alums, 290,000 of them, keep in contact with people around the world, prospective students, new faculty. So there's so many things that are going on in an institution. There isn't a single message. But there is a message of excellence, accessibility, and being a part of the world that is what you're communicating.
Every public relations person I know, including a lot of the media people who watched it, believe that Chancellor Thorpe, for example, should never have conducted a televised press conference to announce the firing of Butch Davis, that you don't call a press conference to announce firings where you're going to be on the defensive. You do that for hirings. Is that the sort of thing that you want your guy or your person, your woman, man or woman, to be tuned into?
Absolutely. The reason I try to keep this distinction is I do think you have to deal with crisis management, and that is a very important part of every university. But you're also dealing, as I say, with this content and this positive presentation of the work that happens here. I think you get in a problem if you think that your public affairs is only about crisis management, too. That would be a very narrow focus on what a complex organization like University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill would be. So I'm looking for all those skills with an expert that knows how to do them and, too, will know how to manage a team that can keep all of that going forward, interfacing with what is already a strong team here.
Is it important in this case, how, given what you said earlier about looking for merit, overall merit, what degree of importance do you attach to someone with a background at UNC?
Again, I think of this one as looking for the very best person in the nation that can help us. We're trying to build a new model for university strategic communications, and I think that's what we're looking for.
You've been listening to a WCHL News Special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. You can listen to this interview in its entirety on our website, chapelboro.com. The following is a special presentation of WCHL News. Now, a WCHL News Special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. Chancellor Folt has officially been on the job for 4 months. And in a four-part series, you'll hear, in a wide range of topics, what the Chancellor has been doing in the early days as leader of North Carolina's flagship university. Now, we continue WCHL's News Special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. Here's part two of the conversation.
Chancellor, you've been asked this 100 times now, I'm sure, so this is not going to be a question that will surprise you. But for our local audience, for our Chapel Hill audience, let's do it again. Now, here in Chapel Hill, we're a public institution. We're the state's flagship school. Really, really important. You're from an Ivy League school way up there in Hanover, New Hampshire, with a total student body enrollment of 6,144, the smallest university in the Ivy League. Wouldn't you just have to start by saying that's a big cultural leap?
I think there's I said this a little bit earlier, I think there is of course there's a big difference between Carolina and Dartmouth. But the core mission, our education, our research, our relationship with our communities is very similar in all of our great universities. I've really enjoyed the scaling up aspect of the job. Even at Dartmouth, we're very embedded in the community. I knew all the legislators in Vermont and New Hampshire. We didn't have the same relationship financially.
Did you get state money there?
No, but we worked very closely with them, and we were, of course, especially we had a hospital that was the leading hospital in the region. So we had many relationships, but not with the same responsibility. But I have really enjoyed that. One of the things that attracted me here was being part of a public institution. So you look at each of these as a growth opportunity, and you build from your past experience. But I've really enjoyed that expansion of the opportunity.
Let's start with the idea, just in terms of how you go about establishing your day. You've got lots of folks here telling you how to spend your day. It has to be much more so than it was at Dartmouth.
Oh, I think everybody fills every day with lots of people and lots of interactions. So I think I'm still filling a pretty busy day, especially early on. I'm trying to distribute my time so I can get out to all the different schools, meet the different constituencies. So I'm getting a lot of advice. You're right. Lots of good ideas about where to go.
When do you have time to think?
I always do schedule and time for thinking. I think that's very important. I do a lot of speeches, and I spend a lot of time thinking about what I want to put into those. So I do those sometimes in the early morning. I'm a morning person. I find that time dispersed through the day.
Style. A lot of attention was given to university travel. You've got an Air Force, and I may miss some of the details on this, but I think that I read or heard that you and I think the President Duke and maybe the Chancellor at NC State drove to Blacksburg.
That's right. We went to the ACC meeting, and we drove up together and drove back 6 hours in the car.
Well, you got planes, and the airport at Blacksburg is right on the campus. Why did you do that?
Well, we wanted to spend the time together, and we really try to minimize the use of the planes, at least for my travel. If it's really necessary, I can use that. But this was a good opportunity for the three of us, and we enjoyed it.
Is that a place to think?
It is. I think that's a great idea. Probably anyone who's had kids also knows that you get your best conversations in a car with some people. So I've always liked car trips. But we had the three of us had a really wonderful trip. And it was fantastic for me early on in my time here to have time with the two of them.
Have you been cautioned about the use of planes? There was a lot of criticism, a lot of attention to the previous chancellor's use of the planes.
Well, I think we're just very aware that we're trying to keep our expenses down and do what we can to really run the institution with the dollars that we have in a very strategic way.
If I ask you about your sort of the management leadership philosophy as applied to how you see it here, do you show up with a sense that things here are on a good path and my idea is to move that path forward, or are you... And you see yourself as a steward of that path, or do you show up here feeling that you're a change agent contemplating big initiatives that will change?
I see myself in both ways. To be in higher education right now, everybody knows that we're facing major change. And some of that is an acceleration of what's already happening in Carolina. So where we are already leading in that crest of that wave, I think it's fantastic. I've had several big opportunities with the deans and other senior leaders to think about what are the things that we're not doing that we want to get involved in? Where is the change coming? And at the same time, thinking about what are the things that we no longer want to do and we want to change. So I think this is a moment of change in higher education, and my position will be to work with people to find the right places where we want to make those changes and steward our momentum in positive ways.
What's sort of the signature initiative of Carol Folt? You know, things that you say, okay, this is what I believe in, things that I want to do, the area of your highest interest, highest skill, highest area of need in terms of what you think we need to be doing that we're not doing that gets us to where we need to be?
I find my interests really focused on the interaction between research and education on the campus. We have some of the leading researchers in the nation and the brightest students. There is already a lot of effort trying to take advantage of that synergy, but I believe personally that that is the thrust of higher education going forward, is taking what faculty do and how they teach all the way out to how you put that to practice in the world. And I think there's an interest of students learning theory and getting breath, but also wanting to take that and put it to practice in the world. I think that new front in higher education is the way we take theory all the way to practice. And so I think that builds on momentum that's already here, but I think we'll see an increasing thrust in that theory to practice throughout all aspects of the institution.
How do you do that?
Well, it's done already in a number of ways. The entrepreneurship minor is a great example of one way to do it. Taking students, I taught in the class on entrepreneurship recently. You've got half the students in that class are first-term students. They're coming in already thinking that what we learn, we can actually think about applying in a business, creating a policy, creating a new application. They have great ideas about how to do it, and they're getting encouragement and skills from the moment they walk in the door. In the sciences, it's not just teaching students about science, it's making sure they're discovering their own science, getting their own experiments, doing their work, and in many cases, taking it all the way to publication. That's that thrust all the way out to practice.
Now, when I listen to your installation speech about the only thing that I heard there that says, I think I have found something that maybe we can do better, that we can fix. You talked about silos. You said, we can lower barriers. Let us de-silo the campus. And then you made reference to that again when you spoke at the Kenan Flagler Business School earlier. So give us an example of what you're referring to. What kind of silos have you observed, and how do you go about breaking it down?
Well, there are silos in every institution. Just the way we're organized is by departments. You think of it that way. And yet, within departments, you no longer have people that were necessarily just of that field. So I'm a biologist. Biologists are departments that no longer just have biologists. They can have mathematicians, they can have chemists, they can have historians. So we organize around curricular fronts, but we work across those disciplines. Biologists work with chemists, work with social scientists. So whatever we can do that can make it easier for faculty to share in the teaching of courses, easier for students to work with faculty from more than one department, in many cases easier to work with faculty across schools. So the biomedical engineering degree that has been created with State and with Carolina is one of the best examples in the nation that I can already see where people have de-siloed and tried to look for a new convergence. That's the kind of work I'm talking about, but it can happen in any department and in any division of the institution.
So when you talk about silos, silos typically grow up in some respects because of turf protection. Are you worried about, are you encountering turf management?
I actually haven't been finding that to be a real problem here, which doesn't mean it wouldn't exist at Carolina. But when I met with the deans and the vice chancellors in our first retreat, we talked a lot about a one UNC approach. What are the things that we can do better working across than we can do from within our own area, discipline, department? And there's a lot of excitement about it because faculty have known that some of the most exciting work always comes when you're in between things. That's where the energy arises. So I think there's a lot of will. Doesn't mean it's always going to be easy. Sometimes you have to give up authority around certain functions that can then be shared. You know, there's decisions that have to come, but there's certainly an appetite here.
One final personnel issue. Chancellor in recent administrations has dedicated someone to be the point person to deal with local relationships in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and Orange County. Do you have such a person?
You know, we're still working on some of these functions, and so people are sharing a lot of those jobs right now. And when I get the full senior team organized, then we'll be able to have a better idea of whether we want that to be a single person or work on it with a team.
You've been listening to a WCHL News Special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. You can listen to this interview in its entirety on our website, chapelboro.com. The following is a special presentation of WCHL News. Now, a WCHL News Special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. Chancellor Folt has officially been on the job for 4 months, and in a four-part series, you'll hear, in a wide range of topics, what the Chancellor has been doing in the early days as leader of North Carolina's flagship university. Now, we continue WCHL's News Special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. Here's part three of the conversation.
Chancellor in athletics. Managing that has been a tar baby. It was certainly for Chancellor Thorpe, Paul Hardin was at SMU, where he did what everyone thought was the right thing, and it got him fired. It was athletics was at the core of what probably caused Chancellor Thorpe to leave. So what's your policy regarding what decisions you make and how you make them regarding athletics?
Well, I've had a great opportunity to get to work closely with the athletic director, Bubba Cunningham. I spent quite a bit of time talking to Chancellor Thorpe before he left about the situations here. You know, and of course, with the Rawlings panel, we've had some great ideas about the ways that we can really work to make sure that the integrity of athletics at Carolina is going to be at the highest standard, and also ways that we can interface with our other institutions. Most directly, working very closely with Jim Dean, we've set up this new initiative where Jim, with Bubba, are looking at every aspect of our touch of athletes from the time they're recruited all the way to the time they graduate. So I'm deeply involved with learning each of those processes through some great leadership and talking about it quite closely with my team. So I feel like we have a good approach to it.
Well, Holden Thorpe was not a big fan of the Rawlings approach. He lectured a sports panel that Bill Friday's and the Knights Commission's views on institutional control are wrong. And if they were ever right at some point, he was very clear in saying that they are outdated. And Hodding Carter, whom I'm sure you know by now, who's on your faculty, he agrees with Bill Friday. They both worked on the Knight Commission's reforms that school presidents or chancellors should assert institutional control over athletics. Chancellor Thorpe disagrees. Now, in the spring, as he was leaving, he told the NNO, "Bill Friday's ghost and Hodding Carter and all those people are ready to kill me," he said, talking about, of course, the late UNC president and your current faculty member, both of whom worked on the reforms for the Knight Commission. And they will not admit, he says, that the idea of presidential control didn't work. So now you have to decide how to do that. So when you look at this landscape, after we get past the philosophy and the policy, do you subscribe more to the Bill Friday doctrine or the Holden Thorpe doctrine of leaving it all to the athletics director?
I think it's ultimately the authority in the chancellor is the responsible person. I have pretty strong feelings about that.
So how do you do that? Let's go in this specific case. P.J. Hairston, are you involved in that?
I'm certainly part of those conversations.
So you do enter into that. So you don't say, Bubba, your job is to manage the P.J. Hairston. You participate in the discussion of how to deal with the with sanctions or the control of a high profile, or whether it's a high profile player or not, a player who is known to have stepped outside the bounds.
You know, Jim, I think you do this the same way you do it with the CFO. I don't try to manage every single part of the budget line, but I certainly am going to talk to people about the way we manage our money. I'm going to work with Bubba on the issues, and I'm also going to respect his ability to manage his division. So it's a conversation that you have, and you talk quite a bit, and you decide where the moment is that you're part of that ultimate decision. But in the end, I have to feel very comfortable with the major decisions that are made.
Well, it's an interesting question because I've watched different chancellors manage this in different ways. Going all the way back, I think Bill Aycock was the first one to articulate the whole idea when he would say to his coaches, play by the rules, show good sportsmanship, and graduate your players. Other than that, your one-loss record, it's not the chancellor's role to worry about the one-loss record. That's the role of the athletic director and the coaches. You agree with that?
Yes.
So in this particular case, why would that cause you to be involved in the P.J. Hairston case?
I don't think the P.J. Hairston case is about winning or losing.
Well, what it does have to do is whether you believe that Bubba have the responsibility. This the implication of this question, it has to do with time management, because time, every chancellor that I know, I've watched the job change from the time that the chancellor could wander over to the Carolina Inn and go to Rotary in the evening and have lunch down at Sutton's, to the point that you've got this. It's a huge bureaucracy. Everything is very carefully managed. And Holden ultimately said that part of what did him in was the fact that this tar baby that we've described it, this business of having the athletics, you step into it a little bit and then it grabs you a little more, and you step into it and it grabs you a little more. You're not worried about that?
I think it's really important that I have a good relation with Bubba, and we also work on issues of great importance for athletics. You know, the athletics environment in Carolina, of course, has a lot to do with the reputation of the institution. I don't think you can imagine that the chancellor is not going to be deeply involved in decisions that are so public. I'm asked by you to comment on things. I'm asked by every reporter. So, of course, I need to understand the full landscape. I also turn to Bubba, who understands the compliance issues. The NCAA has immense expertise as a consultant, as an advisor, as a decision maker. So it's a opportunity to work with people, but there isn't a simple answer as to which time I'm going to get involved. That it's just too simple a question for what is a very complex situation.
So here's what I'm hearing you say. And I would say that what I'm hearing you say is that in this case, you would not say, Bubba, your job is to make sure that they play by the rules. If they play by the rules, if they play by the rules, you've got a job. If they don't play by the rules, you get fired. What I'm hearing you say is that you do involve yourself in specific issues relating to specific players.
I would say that Bubba Cunningham would come to me and say, this is the situation. This is my opinion on how to go forward. And then we would seek opinion of a number of senior leaders, depending on that, not down to the details of every NCAA infraction, but when we're dealing with something that might be a very high-profile issue, or if Bubba has concerns about it, or if we think that this is an important aspect of how Carolina is going to make decisions going forward, I would be involved in it.
I think the other part of the business of athletics, and this is such a it's a huge challenge, and I recognize that the questions are my job is to ask the questions, and I recognize that the answers are not easy in a public forum. But we're trying to get a sense of how we go about doing some of the things that folks in positions of responsibility say they do. According to the Raleigh News and Observer, you told their editors, you said, I think we're going to make significant progress because we really do expect that the athletic part of the house to be at the strength of the academic part, and in fact that those two things should be held to the highest possible standard. Now, those were your words. That's what you had said, I think. Chancellor, I can't name a school in the country that plays big-time football and basketball at the highest standard whose academic standing by the revenue sports players would come close to the highest standards on any of their campuses. So don't you really have to compromise one or the other or possibly both a little bit? Or is that just simply an aspirational statement?
I think it's an aspirational statement. I think Bubba Cunningham's recent strategic plan for the Carolina sports is an excellent one to achieve excellence in all we do. You know, we want to have excellent theater performances. We want our students to compete in the Ethics Bowl in an extremely competitive way. We turn to our students interested in entrepreneurship and say we want them to be successful. So I think we are always aspiring for them to be able to be successful in their endeavors. I believe they also are going to be focused here is on their academic success. Not every student from here is going to graduate with a 4.0, but I want every single one of them
to graduate.
I certainly want them all to graduate and to be able to go forward and make the most out of that education to build a lifetime of leadership. So I think that's what we're talking about aspiring to, and I think that's what we will always continue to aspire to.
Well, I think the part of that that's troublesome is that there's no acknowledgement. It's a very tricky thing, and I don't envy your role in that because you've got to straddle that athletic side with the academic side. Is that we admit students regularly, knowingly, and we're not alone, as all the other Division I schools who want to compete at the highest level. We admit students at the school who are academically marginal and who just keeping them in school is an enormous challenge for the tutors and the folks who are in the athletic department. And the notion of having them perform on a level with the rest of the student body has simply been not something that no one has been able to achieve so far. And I think that's what I'm hearing you say, that you think that that's a reasonable aspiration.
I think you're taking all athletes and putting them in a very narrow bucket. It's a way I don't think about the student athlete.
I'm talking specifically about revenue sports. We're not talking about women's soccer.
You are. When we talk about athletics here and we talk about what we're trying to do, I actually find it very important to continue to remind people that we have a very large academic group of student athletes that excel. And we have students excelling in every one of our revenue sports. And we have actually been achieving a real increase in their graduation rates. Right. The ACC puts a lot of effort into that. I think there's also aspects of athletics that we also want to remember. They also do bring people to college that may not have come, many, most of whom go on and graduate and live a life using their graduation skills. I've heard athletes talk about this in ways that are deeply personal and deeply rewarding, and I believe in that aspect of athletics too. So I want to see it achieve these aspirations we have for it. I think a place like Carolina that brings a student in does have an obligation to help those students be successful. That's what we want to do. And if we bring them in as athletes or we bring them in other aspects of our programs, we still want to put their success first.
Let's talk about your relationship with the coaches. You're their bosses in a real world. There are all sorts of ways to curry the favor of the people that you need to. Bill Friday always lectured us all that the chancellors and the school presidents should not become dazzled by the celebrity of coaches. They make a lot more money than you do. They are much more famous than you are. They are politically, in some cases, seen by a lot of people as more powerful than you are. Bill Friday said he made it a point never to fly on a team plane. Go to the locker room, he said, but never go on the field. And he felt that to do so would compromise his objectivity. What's your policy on that?
I've met the coaches. I've enjoyed that. I haven't actually been on a flight yet with any of the teams. I think Bubba is the manager of the coaches. He's the primary person that you'd work through in those relationships, just like the deans manage their schools and their faculty. So I look for knowing people, but the really responsible party is Bubba.
Would you discuss with Bubba Cunningham, would you participate in a discussion with an athletic director here about the one loss record of your Division I, we are Division I, of your revenue sports teams?
That's not been something that's been what we've been discussing.
That's not important. That has nothing, you're not, that there have been chancellors for whom that's been important and some who have said that that's not the role of the chancellor.
I look at it this way. Everybody in Carolina wants to excel. We have that interest. I think there's an appetite in the athletics department to be successful at every game, just like there's an appetite in every department to get the best grants and be the most active faculty. Our students want to excel. So I'm not feeling a lack of interest in people in excelling. I see the opposite. People really want to do well here.
You've been listening to a WCHL News Special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. You can listen to this interview in its entirety on our website, chapelboro.com. This has been a special presentation of WCHL News. The following is a special presentation of WCHL News. Now, a WCHL News special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. Chancellor Folt has officially been on the job for 4 months. And in a four-part series, you'll hear, in a wide range of topics, what the chancellor has been doing in the early days as leader of North Carolina's flagship university. Now, we conclude WCHL's News special with Jim Hebner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. Here's the fourth and final part of the conversation.
Chancellor Folt, all of the transgressions that we talked about in our earlier parts of the interview occurred before you got here, but you've inherited a job of managing the cleanup of them in the FM scandal aftermath and the issues with athletics. What lessons do you think that you personally or that the institution should have learned from these and or should have learned?
I think they've done a lot of work. The with the accrediting panel coming back and looking at all the new processes were looked at, put in place following the academic issues with the FM. Lots of changes were made. I think people learned a lot about that and are excited about the changes. They feel like they have something in place that they're proud of and they can see things move forward in a positive way. I think that's the same in the athletics department. There are a number of recommendations from the Rawlings panel, for example, that Carolina had already put in place, some of them years ago, some of them more recently, for example, making sure that all the medical care was not under the athletics department but was under different control, just like our academic advising is now moved all the way under our provost office. So in some ways, I think people used these disappointments and these very difficult times, some of them very very troubling, to really make changes that were positive. And they're engaged in them. The people on campus helped design those processes. And so their success is much more likely because of that.
It was under multiple chancellors that the FM department was running these bogus courses. And so when we begin to step into that, it's hard to tell whether that was an issue that I think we would hope that that was just an issue that would involve two people, the chair of the department and the administrator. But nonetheless, that did happen. Can you tell us what controls have been put in place to ensure the integrity of the academic side of things that you're involved in? And how confident are you that they're effective enough that we won't have that happen again?
Well, Jim, this is pretty early for me to tell you all the details. They've all been outlined. I know they've been reported on in the paper quite a few times. But they've put in a lot of oversight, how many independent projects are being done by a single person, the way that's followed through in the department, the way that then goes from the department up to the dean. So there's many, many checks and balances now in place that are observed on a term-by-term basis and reported on with metrics to follow. I think that's what they feel very good about that. And every single dean feels a sense of responsibility to hold to that standard. I think the flip side of all that is, of course, it wasn't taking place in all the other or in any other place that we know of on campus. Sometimes one really distressing, bad set of happenings become the poster child for the way the institution is working. And, of course, that was not the case. In most cases, the processes were safe. In most cases, people were doing all the oversight and management you could ever possibly want. So it isn't a case of changing everything. It's a case of just being even more vigilant to look for those one or two bad apples that are there and make sure that you find them.
We, of course, are always most interested in what's happening in our family, in our town, in our university. But after all this surfaced, it has occurred to me to wonder if there's anyone out there who's has a best practices study on this. Do you know whether this has happened in other schools? Is this, have you any report of this happening in other places? Did you ever have anything like this at Dartmouth?
We didn't have anything specifically like this. I think every school has had its own examples of cheating scandal. I mean, there are things that happen in academics and everybody's aware of them, and usually they're the very rare example, and they do everything possible to put things in place to stop it ever happening again. I know that one of the ways people think about it, though, is let's get everything in place so they never do happen. You don't want it to have to be reactive. So when people address something like what happened here in Chapel Hill, they've put in place ways to prevent this happening that now affect all courses. So you use it as an opportunity to become preventive as well. But I don't know of another exact example.
Now, you are facing, for the first time in our history, you're coming to North Carolina to be the chancellor here for the first time in history with our first legislature that's all Republican and very conservative. Governor McCrory has excoriated the educational elite who he says dominate the schools, and he's obviously pointing at Chapel Hill. He says the schools teach worthless courses that offer no chances of people getting jobs. This was in a national radio interview, got a lot of attention. He said there was a major disconnect between what skills are taught at the state's public universities and what businesses want out of colleges. And so just to make this very clear, he said, so These are his words, I'm going to adjust my educational curriculum. And I would say this are my words, not his. I don't know whether he is the adjuster of the curriculum, but that's what he said. I'm going to adjust my educational curriculum to what business and commerce needs to our kids. Jobs to get our kids jobs, as opposed to moving back in with their parents after graduation with debt. What we are teaching in these courses for is nothing that'll help them get a job. And then he went on to say, but if you want gender studies, that's fine. Go to a private school and take it. But I don't want to subsidize that if it's not going to get help get someone a job. Well, the problem is that his view is likely reflected in the legislative leadership that may be more conservative than he is. So how do you respond to that?
I think the most important issue in facing higher education is dealing with this value proposition. Are we, in our great publics, creating students and preparing for the future? Our mission has always been create critical knowledge, be the innovation generators for new business and changes and advances in culture and civilization, and then create the workforce best prepared to advance. I believe deeply that places like Carolina, amongst the best in the nation, does that extremely well. We bring these bright students in, we give them an incredible breadth of understanding, and then we give them depth. Each one of them has a major, sometimes two majors, that have detailed skills taking them all the way to the forefront of knowledge in that area, and these skills are deeply transferable. The skills we want for the future are the skills for students that can prepare themselves not for the jobs that are sitting there today, but for the jobs and creating the jobs of tomorrow. If you think about digital world, the jobs that our students are getting now didn't even exist 10 or 15 years ago. So we need to continue what we do is make them extremely prepared to go into the industries of today, but even more so to be flexible and create the industries of tomorrow. Carolina does it. It has a graduation. I saw some statistics recently that said 85% of the students that graduate from Carolina within the first year have full-time jobs or in graduate school. It's up there at the levels of the highest of our elites. We'll continue to press forward on that. And I feel proud of what they're doing post-graduation. And I think they're going to be the people that are helping to bring new economies into the state.
We probably ought to come back and schedule another hour just to talk about money, because at the end of the day, it's income and outgo. Where do you get the money, and then where do you spend it? And so I'm going to try to summarize in the limited time we have here to two things. One is the internal politics. How much time do you spend in Raleigh working the halls of the legislature?
I've been over there several times. I was there when I first came. My second day I went there. And I've also been trying to meet the delegation in Washington. So that's been great. I've also met some people out in the districts when I've been going out around the state. So I see it as very important.
I'm wondering if there may be some good news I would think it's a safe generalization to say that the more the university can find a way to keep its business out of politics, the better things are. I think that'd be a non-controversial statement. And the politics is local, and local money is typically more likely to be swayed by at least political rhetoric, if not political action. So one of the things that's really happening is I've been watching this over the last few years. Without drowning us in numbers, Raleigh's appropriations and grants have continued to drop from it peaked out in 2008. It's actually $654 million at that time, down to $606 million, down to a drop of $48 million. In that same period of time, the federal government grant support to the university has grown from $550 million to $760 million. So today, you're getting $154 million more from the federal government than you got from Raleigh. So that's an interesting trend, and it appears to be a trend. Well, first of all, do you believe that trend is likely to continue, that ratio?
I think it will. I think we are seeing a change in the balance of the dollars, where they come from into the university, and I think that's happened in universities around the country.
And what then might be true, does that make it less political?
You know, I think our mission to educate and create knowledge is really not political. It is what we've been trying to do for 220 years. My goal is to work on those key issues, the way we produce knowledge, the students that we educate, and the value we bring to the community. And I think that is as important to Raleigh as it would have been under any political leadership. My first conversation with Governor McCrory, I said, I want Carolina to be your best story, the piece of Carolina, of North Carolina, that you're most proud of and to do the most for this community. And I still think that's our goal.
Chancellor, speaking of money, we've got lots of infrastructure issues here. When I've studied, each year I study this, and we've got more and more. The amount of work here that's not being done because you don't have the money on crumbling infrastructure seems to me to be something we can talk about a lot. Digital education is a huge issue that's facing the university and all the other things that are changing in the world. So I hope we'll be able to, our time is gone. I hope we'll be able to come back maybe and talk about those things because they are certainly going to have a major impact on. We've talked a lot about where the university is today. I'm not sure we've really had a chance to talk as much about the university of the future as I would like. I hope you'll come back and let us do that again sometime in the future.
Love to do that, Jim. Thank you.
You've been listening to a WCHL News Special with Jim Hefner and UNC Chancellor Carol Folt. You can listen to this interview in its entirety on our website, chapelboro.com. This has been a special presentation of WCHL News.